Judaism within the Declaration of Independence. What are Judeo-Christian values, and in what ways did these values influence the political philosophies or documents created by America's founding fathers? Where did their inspiration for these values come from? Thomas Jefferson, who famously identified John Locke and Algernon Sidney as two of the primary.
Elementary books of public right.
That informed the American mind was deeply influenced by their dismantling of absolute power through the lens of contractual marriage. In his two treatises of government, Locke directly counters the argument that a husband's power is absolute, and therefore a king's power is absolute, by defining marriage as a voluntary, conditional agreement, a concept mirroring the Jewish ketubah, which John Selden had popularized in scholarly circles. Locke writes in the Second Treatise, section 82.
Husband and wife, though they have but one common concern, yet having different understandings, will unavoidably sometimes have different wills, but this reaches not to the power of life and death, nor does it give the husband the power of an absolute monarch.
By establishing that the domestic sphere was governed by contract and peculiar right rather than divine decree, Locke and Sidney provided Jefferson with the intellectual template to argue that political authority was similarly limited. This conditional contract logic appears as the bedrock of the Declaration of Independence. Just as the Ketubah stipulates that a marriage remains valid only as long as the husband fulfills his specific duties, food, clothing, conjugal rights, Jefferson structured the Declaration as a legal brief for a national divorce. He argues that the king held his position only through a voluntary compact with the colonies, and because the king had violated the specific terms of that contract, enumerated in Jefferson's list of grievances, the bond was legally dissolved. When Jefferson wrote that governments
derive their just powers from the consent of the governed,
he was applying the Lockean and Sidneyan principle that authority is not inherent or biological, but transactional and revocable, a revolutionary idea that owes a quiet debt to the Hebraic conception of covenanted relationships. Algernon Sidney and John Locke utilized the biblical narrative of the prophet Samuel, specifically the transition from the Hebrew Republic to the monarchy in 1 Samuel 8, to argue that all legitimate political power is derived from the will of the people rather than divine imposition. In his Discourses Concerning Government, Sidney dismantles the royalist argument that God ordained monarchy, pointing instead to God's instruction to Samuel,
"Hearken unto the voice of the people, in all that they say unto thee." 1 Samuel 8:7.
Sidney interprets this not as a divine endorsement of kings, but as God acknowledging the people's fundamental right to choose their own form of government, even if that choice is flawed. As Sidney writes,
"God did not institute monarchy, but the people asked it,"
thereby proving that the power was in them to institute or abrogate their rulers. Sidney, Discourses, Chapter 2, Section 6. This established the radical precedent that a king's authority exists only because the people consented to it, a direct rebuttal to the divine right theory that Jefferson would later echo in the Declaration. Furthermore, these thinkers argued that the Jewish king was neither absolute nor permanent, but rather a conditional officer strictly bound by the laws of the nation, specifically the restrictions outlined in Deuteronomy 17. Sidney contrasts the manner of the king, Mishpat Hamalek, warned of in Samuel, which described a tyrant who takes property, with the law of the kingdom in Deuteronomy, which subjugated the king to the Torah. Sidney observes that the Jewish king was
not to multiply horses, silver or gold, and that he should keep the law of God,
implying that a king who violates these constraints breaks the legal covenant and forfeits his crown. Discourses, Chapter 3, Section 7. This view of the Judaic king as a revocable magistrate rather than an absolute sovereign provided the theological and legal framework for the American founders to argue that a ruler who acts against the law and the will of the people, as King George III did, ceases to be a king and may be lawfully removed. Long before John Locke or Thomas Jefferson articulated the concept of the consent of the governed, the sages of the Talmud established the legal principle that political authority is invalid without the explicit approval of the populace. In the Babylonian Talmud, Rabbi Yitzchak issues a sweeping dictum regarding public office.
We do not appoint a leader over the community unless the community is consulted. Ein Mamid in Panas, Al Ha Tzibur, Elaim Ken Nimlakim Bat Tzibur. Babylonian Talmud, Berakot 55a.
This ruling dismantled the ancient Near Eastern model of kingship, which viewed power as a top-down imposition from the gods. Instead, the Talmud posits that leadership is a partnership. A ruler installed without the people's consultation lacks legitimate authority, regardless of their qualifications. To anchor this radical idea in the Torah, Rabbi Yitzchak cites the appointment of Bezalel, the chief architect of the tabernacle. According to the Talmudic exegesis, God explicitly asks Moses,
"Is Bezalel considered worthy in your eyes?" When Moses affirms that Bezalel is worthy, God responds with a stunning instruction. "Nevertheless, go and speak to them, the people." Berakot 55a.
Even though Bezalel was divinely selected by God and approved by the greatest prophet Moses, the appointment could not be finalized until Moses went to the Israelites and asked, "Is Bezalel considered worthy in your eyes?" This narrative establishes that divine choice does not supersede human consent. God himself refuses to bypass the electorate, creating a theological precedent where the voice of the people is a necessary component of the divine command. This Talmudic framework offers a striking parallel to the republican ideals later adopted by the American founders. Just as Jefferson argued in the Declaration of Independence, that governments
derive their just powers from the consent of the governed.
The Jewish legal tradition argued that even the holiest of endeavors, building the tabernacle, required democratic validation. By insisting that not even God acts as an autocrat in matters of civil appointment, the Talmud suggests that the Hebrew Republic was not a theocracy in the traditional sense, but a system of divinely mandated consent, ensuring that the leader acts as a representative of the community rather than its owner. The Talmud explicitly establishes that a legitimate king is not immune to prosecution, but is a subject of the law, liable to be sued and judged by the judiciary. In the Mishnah and Gemara, a sharp distinction is drawn between the non-Davidic kings of Israel, who were deemed too violent to judge, and the ideal kings of the house of David. Regarding the Davidic line, the Talmud states,
"The kings of the house of David judge, and are judged by others, they give testimony, and testimony is given concerning them." Babylonian Talmud, Sanhedrin 19a.
This legal maxim asserts that the monarch is equal to any other citizen in the eyes of the court. He can be dragged before the Sanhedrin Supreme Court to answer for crimes or civil disputes. This concept is vividly illustrated in the Talmudic account of King Yanai, who was summoned by the Sanhedrin to stand trial for his slave's crimes. The sage Shimon ben Shetach famously ordered the king,
"Stand on your feet and let the witnesses testify against you. You are not standing before us, but before the one who spoke, and the world came into being." Sanhedrin 19a.
Algernon Sidney seized upon this specific aspect of Jewish jurisprudence in his Discourses Concerning Government to refute the idea that kings are accountable only to God. Sidney argues that the Hebrew kings were never absolute sovereigns, but were officers under the jurisdiction of the Sanhedrin. He writes,
"The Jews had a Sanhedrin who had power to judge the king, and that the king was subject to the same law as the people." Sidney, Discourses, Chapter 2, Section 24.
Sidney explicitly contrasts the absolute power demanded by European monarchs with the regulated power of the Jewish kings, concluding that because the king could be judged by men, he was not a god on earth. John Locke reinforces this in his first treatise of government, mocking the idea that the biblical kings had paternal, absolute power. He notes that the judges and kings were often chosen by the people, and therefore could not claim a divine right to ignore the laws of the nation. First Treatise, Section 163-169. For both thinkers, the Sanhedrin's power to compel a king to stand on his feet was historical proof that liberty requires a ruler who can be overruled by a judge. The Shtar Hitkashrut, contract of bonding, while popularized by Hasidic groups like Breslov and Chabad, is not a modern innovation but deeply rooted in the mystical and legal traditions of the Radbaz, Rabbi David Ibn Zimra, and the Arizal, Rabbi Isaac Luria. Historians note that the disciples of the Arizal in Saft famously signed a mutual pledge of spiritual brotherhood, a practice that likely drew upon even earlier precedents from the Gaonim, who formalized the power of written enactments to bind communities. These sages understood that the legal mechanics of a shtar, contract, could be elevated from a mere financial tool into a vessel for spiritual unity, creating a klei, vessel, that binds souls just as effectively as it binds assets. This spiritualization of contract law mirrors the evolution of the shtar iska, trustee pledge. Perfected during the Geonic period to facilitate trade without violating interest laws, the iska transforms a borrower into a sheliuk, agent, managing funds for an investor. The critical element here is ne'emanut, trustworthiness. The manager is contractually deemed as credible as two witnesses. Just as the Radbaz and Arizal emphasize the power of a vow to bind one's conscience, the iska relies on a bond of total faith, where the party's relationship is defined not by coercion, but by the manager's solemn word and integrity. The concept of binding is further legally grounded in the shtar shut, partnership contract. In halakha, forming a partnership creates a status of arevut, guarantorship, where each partner essentially becomes the long arm of the other. The Arizal's students utilize this legal reality of arevut, traditionally used for financial liability, and applied it to spiritual responsibility. Just as a business partner is liable for his colleague's debt, the signatories of these mystical contracts pledged to be answerable for one another's spiritual standing, a concept that predates the Hasidic movement by centuries. Paralleling these Jewish legal forms were the guild oaths of the medieval era, which functioned as brotherhood contracts for the material world. Much like the communal enactments, takanot, of the Gaonim, these guild contracts bound members to support one another in life and death, fusing economic survival with social loyalty. A member of a guild was not an isolated worker, but part of a corporate body. Similarly, the Hitkashrut contracts of the Saft mystics ensured that no individual served God in isolation, but rather as part of a unified body of believers. The mechanism for this connection is best illustrated by the Talmudic principle of Mayamad Shloshtan, the stand of three. This unique legal rule allows for the transfer of debt or loyalty instantly through the physical presence of three parties, without the need for a tangible exchange. It represents a meeting of minds that creates a binding reality. The Kabbalists of the Arizal school viewed this as the legal prototype for spiritual flow. The presence of the Rebbe, the Hasid, and the divine creates a triangular bond that allows influence to transfer instantly, transcending physical limitations. Ultimately, the Shtarhit Kashrut is the realization of the Arizal and Radbaz's vision, using the garments of halakhic contract law to effectuate deep spiritual realities. By adapting the ancient structures of the Iska, the Shut, and the Mayamad, they demonstrated that the language of pledge and surety is the most potent way to unify disparate souls. This tradition of using legal frameworks for high moral purpose echoes through history, finding a later resonance in the Declaration of Independence, where the founders used the ancient formula of mutually pledging lives and fortunes to bind a new nation together. John Locke's political theory fundamentally reimagined the relationship between ruler and subject by employing a legal structure that strikingly mirrors the Jewish Shtar Iska, trustee contract. Just as the Iska transforms a transaction into a fiduciary relationship, where a manager acts as a trusted agent, shaliach, for an investor, Locke defined government not as a divine right, but as a fiduciary power entrusted to the ruler for the benefit of the people. In his second treatise of government, Locke argues that the legislative power is merely a fiduciary power to act for certain ends, and therefore,
there remains still in the people a supreme power to remove or alter the legislative when they find the legislative act contrary to the trust reposed in them. Section 149.
This logic precisely matches the Iska mechanism. The ruler, like the investment manager, holds authority only so long as he faithfully executes the trust. If he acts for his own enrichment rather than the investors, the people's benefit, the contract is voided by his own breach of faith. Algernon Sidney complements this by emphasizing the reciprocity of the bond, paralleling the Shtar Shut partnership contract and the Shtar Hit Kashrut. In a Jewish partnership, the parties are aravim, guarantors for one another, bound by mutual liability. Sidney applies this exact logic to the crown, arguing in his Discourses Concerning Government that the
contract between the magistrate and people is mutual, and explicitly stating that if he does not perform his part, he loses the right of exacting that which is stipulated on the other. Chapter 2, Section 32.
By using the language of stipulation, the defining feature of a conditional bond, Sidney destroys the idea of unconditional surrender to a king. He posits that political allegiance is a two-way street of mutual surety, where the people's loyalty is contractually contingent on the king's protection, just as a Hasid's pledge in a Hit Kashrut is contingent on the Rebbe's spiritual guidance. Finally, both thinkers invoke a concept that mirrors the Mamad, or the third-party guarantor, essential to these Jewish contracts, the appeal to heaven. In Jewish law, when two parties cannot resolve a betrayal of trust, they rely on the divine as the witness and guarantor of the bond. Locke formalizes this in political theory, writing that when a ruler betrays his trust, and there is no judicature on earth to decide controversies,
the people have a final reserve, which they can invoke, which is the appeal to heaven. Second Treatise, Section 168.
This is not a call for prayer, but for revolution, a declaration that the earthly contract is broken and the parties are now submitting their case to the Supreme Judge. This triangular structure, people, king, and God, mirrors the Ma'amad Shloshtan, establishing that the validity of the political contract ultimately relies on the silent partner, divine providence, to judge who kept their word. The famous final line reads,
"And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor."
Here is how this sentence functions as a Judaic-style covenantal business contract. 1. The structure of mutual surety. Aravut.
In Jewish law, the most powerful form of partnership is aravut, guarantorship. The phrase, we mutually pledge to each other, mirrors the Talmudic concept of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebaze. All Israel are guarantors for one another. The business parallel. In a standard shtar shut partnership contract, partners are liable for the business's debts. The declaration parallel. The 56 signers were not just signing a political opinion, they were signing a death warrant together. By saying mutually pledge, they were creating a legal reality where they stood as human shields for one another. If the revolution failed, they would not be tried as individuals. They would hang as a collective. They became co-signers on a debt of treason.
2. The three collaterals, life, money, and soul.
A standard contract lists the shibud nekasim, the assets that are leaned to guarantee the debt. The declaration lists three specific assets that perfectly map onto Jewish categories of self. Our lives. Guf/body. This is the physical commitment. In a time of war, this was literal. Many signers were captured, tortured, or died of exhaustion. They put their physical guf on the table as collateral. Our fortunes. Maimon/money. This is the financial commitment. Just like a shtar iska puts capital at risk, the signers pledged their wealth. Carter Braxton of Virginia, a wealthy planter and trader, lost his ships to the British Navy and died in debt. They were underwriting the revolution with their private bank accounts. Our sacred honor. Shemtov/good name. This is the spiritual asset. In the 18th century and in Jewish thought, a person's honor was their social currency and legacy. If they turned back on this pledge, they would not just be broke or dead. They would be traitors and liars. They were staking their immortal reputation.
3. The silent partner, divine providence.
The line includes, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. This mirrors the Ma'amad Shloshtan, the stand of three, or the Shtar Iska. In a Jewish business contract, like the Iska, God is often invoked as the witness or the third partner who ensures success. By invoking divine providence right before the pledge, Jefferson and the signers were saying, we are the active partners doing the work, pledging lives/fortunes, but we rely on the silent partner, God, to provide the protection, return on investment.
Summary, the shtar of a new nation.
You can view the Declaration of Independence not just as a letter to King George, but as a shtar hitkashrut between the 56 signers. It was a contract where the consideration was liberty. The partners were the colonies, the collateral was life, fortune, and honor, and the guarantor was God. Like the Hasidic shtar hitkashrut, it was an existential bond. They were no longer 56 individuals, but a single corporate body, bound by a vow of loyalty.
While many signers suffered, the man who arguably paid the highest immediate financial price, literally destroying his own estate to fulfill his pledge, was Thomas Nelson Jr. of Virginia. His story is the ultimate proof that the Fortunes Clause was not a metaphor.
Thomas Nelson Jr., the man who bombed his own house. Nelson was a wealthy planter and the wartime governor of Virginia. By 1781, the war had come to his doorstep in Yorktown. The sacrifice. During the siege of Yorktown, American and French forces were bombarding the British, who were holed up in the town. Nelson noticed that the American artillery gunners were avoiding firing at one specific building, his own magnificent mansion, which was being used as the headquarters for the British General Cornwallis. The order. Nelson rode up to the gunners and asked why they weren't firing. They replied they were respecting his property. Nelson famously shouted, "Give me the cannon," and ordered them to fire directly at his own home to flush out the enemy. He offered a reward of 5 guineas to the first gunner who could hit his house. The aftermath. His home was destroyed. Furthermore, Nelson had personally raised $2 million, in today's currency, to fund the Virginia militia, using his own credit because the state had no credit left. He was never repaid. He died a few years later at age 50, living in a small shack, entirely bankrupt.
The financier, Robert Morris.
While Nelson destroyed his physical house, Robert Morris of Pennsylvania destroyed his vast commercial empire. Known as the financier of the Revolution, Morris personally underwrote the war effort. When the Continental Army had no food or gunpowder, Morris used his own notes, personal IOUs, to buy supplies. In the process, he lost 150 ships from his merchant fleet to the British Navy, a staggering loss of capital. By the end of his life, the man who had effectively paid for the War of Independence went bankrupt and spent 3 years in a debtor's prison. The signer who paid the most complex and painful price, sacrificing not just his property and health, but temporarily his sacred honor, was Richard Stockton of New Jersey. His story is the most tragic because the British specifically targeted him to break his spirit, and for a brief moment, they succeeded. The tragedy of Richard Stockton. Stockton was a distinguished judge and a wealthy lawyer who lived at a beautiful estate called Morven. He signed the Declaration, knowing he was a prime target.
1. The capture, the price of life.
In late 1776, British troops invaded New Jersey. Stockton managed to move his family to safety, but he was betrayed by loyalist neighbors and captured in the middle of the night. He was marched in freezing weather to Perth Amboy and then to the notorious Provost Jail in New York City. The conditions were horrific. He was starved, denied warm clothing during a freezing winter, and subjected to brutal treatment meant to break him physically.
2. The recantation, the price of honor.
This is the most controversial part of his story. After weeks of brutal misery and hearing false reports that the American cause was collapsing, Stockton's resolve cracked. To secure his release and perhaps save his family's home, he signed an oath of allegiance to King George III and promised not to participate in the war effort. He was the only signer of the Declaration to formally recant his signature while in captivity. When he was released, battered and starving, he returned to New Jersey, but his reputation was in tatters. Other patriots looked at him with suspicion. He had to retake an oath of loyalty to the United States to regain his standing, but the shadow of his betrayal haunted him.
3. The aftermath, the price of fortune.
While he was in prison, the British Army occupied his estate, Morven. They looted his furniture and clothing. They burned his extensive library, one of the best in the colonies. They drove off his livestock. Stockton never recovered his health from the prison abuse. He developed cancer, likely exacerbated by the malnutrition, and died in 1781 at the age of 50. He died broke, physically broken, and emotionally scarred by the compromise he had been forced to make.
The ultimate lesson of the pledge.
Stockton's story proves that the pledge was not empty rhetoric. When they pledged their sacred honor, they understood that the pressure to turn traitor would be immense. Stockton's temporary failure highlights the superhuman courage of the other 55 and makes the collective bond of the Declaration even more poignant. The other signers didn't punish him. They understood the hell he had been through. The Declaration of Independence is widely understood as a political contract based on the Enlightenment philosophy of John Locke, life, liberty, and property. However, this secular reading often ignores the document's final sentence, which shifts from a demand for rights into a sacrificial vow. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. This shift marks a transition from political theory to a spiritual covenant, one that mirrors the ancient biblical formula of total devotion found in the Shema, Deuteronomy 6:5. The first parallel lies in the pledge of our lives, which corresponds to the biblical command to love God b'chol nafshecha, with all your soul/life. In the Hebraic tradition, nefesh is the physical life force. To offer it is the ultimate sacrifice, or Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of the name. The signers of the declaration were not merely risking political office. They were signing their own death warrants for treason. By placing their physical bodies on the line, they were enacting the most primal requirement of a covenant, the willingness to die for the survival of the community. The second element, our fortunes, offers a striking linguistic and thematic match to the Hebrew b'chol meodecha, with all your might. While meod literally means very, the authoritative Jewish interpretation, Mishnah Berakot 9:5, defines it as b'chol mamonecha, with all your money. The sages understood that for some, wealth is more guarded than life itself, requiring a specific command to surrender it. Jefferson's substitution of fortunes, a sacrificial asset, for property, a protected right, aligns perfectly with this Hebraic insight. The new republic could not be born without the material ruin of its founders. The final element, sacred honor, serves as the counterpart to b'chol levavcha, with all your heart. In biblical anthropology, the lev, heart, is the seat of the will, conscience, and moral integrity, not just emotion. Liberty would not fit here, as liberty is an external condition that can be taken away by a tyrant. Honor, however, is an internal state of character that can only be forfeited by the self. By pledging their sacred honor, the signers were offering up their souls and reputations, their hearts, as the final collateral in their pact. Ultimately, whether by conscious imitation or convergent evolution, the Declaration of Independence concludes with a triad of total commitment that matches the Torah's requirements for devotion: the self, nafshecha/lives, the assets, meodecha/fortunes, and the conscience, levavcha/honor. This suggests that the American founding was not just a political separation from England, but the ratification of a new covenant, requiring the same total surrender of self that the Torah demands of the faithful.
John Adams' letter to Abigail Adams. Date, August 14, 1776. Source, Adams Family Papers. In this private letter, Adams gives Abigail the inside scoop on the different ideas proposed by the committee members, himself, Franklin, and Jefferson.
Mr. Jefferson proposed, "The children of Israel in the wilderness, led by a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, and on the other side, Hengist and Horsa, the Saxon chiefs, from whom we claim the honor of being descended, and whose political principles and form of government we have assumed." Mr. Franklin proposed, "Moses lifting up his wand and dividing the Red Sea, and Pharaoh, in his chariot, overwhelmed with the waters." This motto, "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God."
At the time of the American Revolution in 1776, the cartography of the 13 colonies already featured a significant, though geographically concentrated, number of biblically named settlements. Approximately 50 to 75 such towns existed, primarily clustered in New England and Pennsylvania. This initial wave of naming was driven by religious dissenters, Puritans, Quakers, and Moravians, who viewed their migration as a spiritual journey to a new Israel. They chose names reflecting divine providence, refuge, or Old Testament lands, such as Salem, Jerusalem, Massachusetts, Providence, Rhode Island, and Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Stuart, names on the land. These early names were deliberate theological statements by communities seeking to distinguish their new societies from the corruptions of the old world. Alstrom, A Religious History of the American People. The truly massive proliferation of biblical place names occurred after the Revolution, coinciding with the era of westward expansion and the intense religious revival known as the Second Great Awakening, circa 1790 to 1840. As pioneers pushed the frontier westward across the Appalachians, into the Midwest and beyond, they founded thousands of new communities during a period of heightened evangelical fervor. This era saw a distinct shift toward New Testament names associated with the early growth of the Christian church, rather than just Old Testament territories, Hatch, the democratization of American Christianity. It was during this 19th century expansion that the American map became dotted with dozens of towns named Antioch, Corinth, and Damascus, reflecting a desire by settlers to plant new spiritual communities in the wilderness. The truly massive proliferation of biblical place names occurred after the Revolution, coinciding with the era of westward expansion and the intense religious revival known as the Second Great Awakening, circa 1790 to 1840. As pioneers pushed the frontier westward across the Appalachians into the Midwest and beyond, they founded thousands of new communities during a period of heightened evangelical fervor. This era saw a distinct shift toward New Testament names associated with the early growth of the Christian church, rather than just Old Testament territories, the democratization of American Christianity. It was during this 19th century expansion that the American map became dotted with dozens of towns named Antioch, Corinth, and Damascus, reflecting a desire by settlers to plant new spiritual communities in the wilderness. Conclusion: Jefferson and the influence of Hebrew Republic ideologies. In conclusion, it is clear that Thomas Jefferson's work on the Declaration of Independence was profoundly shaped by the notion of divine intervention. Many aspects of the document reflect the foundational principles and philosophies advanced by scholars who were themselves inspired by the ideologies and concepts of the Hebrew Republic. This connection underscores the deep intellectual and spiritual influences that informed Jefferson's vision and the crafting of one of America's most significant founding texts.